From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this last week, and there's a lot to get to. So today, our panel includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
All right. I should note my children have the day off of school, so anything is possible with live radio.
Joey, get your iPad.
Exactly. Let's just be fully transparent on what could happen in the next hour. All right. With that said, Audrey, I would really like to begin with you. You recently wrote some in-depth pieces on an investigation that you've been doing into Dr. Ryan Cole. So first, can you just give us a refresher on who Dr. Cole is?
Sure. So Dr. Ryan Cole is a pathologist. He owns Cole Diagnostics, or he's a CEO and medical director of Cole Diagnostics, which is a laboratory in Garden City. And he is also the sole physician on the Central District Health Public Health Board. And he is medical director of the America's Frontline Doctors and is a regular speaker at some events that basically talk about COVID and early treatment and things like that, using the using things like ivermectin.
Mm-hmm. And he is not an advocate of the COVID vaccines, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So he's called the COVID vaccines a number of kind of derogatory terms and has basically said that he believes that they're harmful, that they've caused countless deaths, relying mostly on a database that is not to be used for statistical analysis. It's called the VAERS database. And so he speaks often about COVID vaccines and what he says that he personally has seen in his laboratory. So so about 6 months ago, I started looking at, you know, what actually is going on in his laboratory. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with three of his former employees, pulled a lot of records and documents and data, and kind of mapped it out.
Okay, so let's talk about that more in depth, because these former employees are saying that he was reckless in his lab. You also uncovered that he potentially misused COVID-19 funds. So let's start with the COVID-19 funds first.
Okay. It's pretty, so the story goes into detail that I hope makes sense for people, but
it does. It does. There's a lot to it, Audrey, but it does make sense.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. So essentially, he received some grants to purchase equipment to help ramp up COVID testing in Idaho, because as everyone knows, COVID testing in 2020 and 2021 wasn't always easily accessible. Turnaround times were really slow, and he offered to help bring more testing supply into the market. So he received those grants. His former employees said that the money was not, you know, the equipment that was in those sub-grants was not used mm-hmm. for COVID testing, and couldn't be used for COVID testing with the kind of work process that they had in the lab. And then in addition, there's kind of a premium pay option for certain COVID tests if they're done on this rather expensive equipment and fully automated. And so you can get a little bit of a higher pay rate because it's more expensive to run the tests in that way, but is also faster. And so Medicare said, hey, we will pay you more for that if you bill these because you're running them on this more expensive to run equipment. And when I talked with the employees, they said, no, we didn't even have the equipment that you would need to qualify for this. and Medicare had listed some examples, and they're all kind of fully automated systems. And they said, no, we didn't have any of these until at least late 2021. So I went and I looked at his Medicaid billing data and looked at the codes that were used for the billing. And those were the premium pay codes prior to late 2021. So, according to what the lab employees were saying and the billing records, there's a question of whether it was properly billed.
Okay. So we have questions of proper things being properly billed or not. The other thing that some of these employees are alleging, one employee that you spoke with was the former molecular diagnostic supervisor, and he says that in his view, what Dr. Cole was doing was reckless and it was, quote, volume over safety and accuracy. Because Audrey, he's saying, these employees are saying that that Cole made changes in the labs, in the lab protocols that would have caused people with COVID-19 to actually receive negative test results. Is that correct?
Right. There are two different kind of categories of what they were pointing to. One was just an overall kind of lax approach to maintaining the integrity of the test. So, double checking a patient's name, like if it came in on the test as Katie, that making sure it was Catherine or something like that. And also the storage of the test specimens before they were run. So they have to be stored in a certain way, right? And then also they said that they did on occasion see him reconstitute samples like by putting in more liquid to, if they had dried out, which is not something that is in the emergency use authorization for that test. And then the kind of second category has to do with something called a cycle threshold. And I'm not going to get into that, but basically the FDA approved certain tests, right? And those tests are approved based on what the manufacturers tested them with to make sure that they were accurate. And so they set certain parameters. And if you want to go outside of those parameters, you have to basically get FDA approval to do that as your own test, because you're changing the way that you're running the test. They said, and he has confirmed in his public comments that he lowered a certain threshold below what the manufacturer said it should be. So tests that maybe would have been positive if the threshold had been higher, according to the manufacturer's specifications, would now show negative.
Okay. And you did reach out to Dr. Cole. Did he respond to you?
Yeah, I sent an email and I sent a certified letter, and I laid out all of the findings because I wanted to make sure, one, he had an opportunity to comment, and two, if we got something wrong, or we didn't have proper context, we want to know that. And he responded with an email directing me to attorney Stephen Biss, who has represented former Congressman Devin Nunes in a number of unsuccessful lawsuits against media outlets and others, people on Twitter, over what they called defamatory speech. So I contacted Mr. Biss. I called him. I sent him three emails. He hasn't responded.
All right. So that's where we are with this right now. So Audrey, as you were uncovering all of this, it's a lot to take in. You also uncovered how much money Dr. Cole and Cole Diagnostics received. So here is a person who does not believe that the COVID-19 vaccine works, yet was also giving out COVID tests, speaks out against really the proven treatments for COVID, yet receives, what, more than $1 million from all of this?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yes, that's what we were able to identify through public records. So that's based on what, you know, federal pandemic aid that his laboratory received, and the grants from the state for that equipment. And then in addition, there's also the testing. And of course, there are expenses that come with testing. It's not like it's free to do. But from Medicaid alone, it was hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we'll eventually get the Medicare data as well and be able to see how much that was. We will probably never see what, you know, what private insurance paid or people who self-paid provided to the lab in exchange for their tests. But we do know that, you know, his lab charges almost $100 for PCR tests. And Medicaid was reimbursing at about $90 per test. So it's a lot. It's a lot of money. And I've talked with him before about, you know, I kind of did back of the envelope math on he had said he'd processed 100,000 COVID tests in the year prior to applying for Central District Health Board. And I said, well, if you're doing $99 a test, wouldn't that be like $10 million almost? And he said, no, we haven't made anywhere near half of that. And then, you know, some of his other comments kind of were a little bit different from that. But we just have no way of knowing how much the net income was on those. There's just not a way to confirm that, but it's clear that it was a large income source. So we charted all of the Medicaid payments he received for COVID-19 tests and the payments that he received for all other services. So you can see that in the story. And you can see how COVID-19 testing became a very, very large chunk of his business, or chunk of Cole Diagnostics business over the pandemic.
And we will post that story on our website as well. So Scott, another big story this week was the leaked draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court in regards to Roe v. Wade. And you wrote an opinion piece about what this would mean for Idaho if Roe is overturned. Let's talk a little bit more about that, Scott, because there are huge ramifications for this, to say the least.
Right. And, you know, to sum up, the ruling was that abortion is not a fundamental right protected under the U.S. Constitution. And so therefore, states are allowed to regulate abortion. And so what the ruling, if it does come to pass, as it is expected, that it basically turns the job of regulating abortions back over to the states, and ruling that the states can ban abortion or highly regulate them. And so 2 years ago in 2020, the Idaho legislature passed what's known as a trigger law, basically saying that if the U.S. Supreme Court ever overturns Roe v. Wade, then that would trigger this law passed by the legislature that would ban abortion, make it illegal in Idaho, except for cases of rape, incest, and when the question of the health of the mother is at issue. So, you know, I know that it came as a shock to a lot of people that this draft opinion was released, leaked, this week. But clearly, in 2020, there were some people who knew what was coming down the pike, and sure enough, appears to be coming to pass. And so if and when the Supreme Court issues its final ruling and overturns Roe v. Wade, then in Idaho, abortion would become illegal, except for cases of rape, incest, and the health of the mother.
And so, Scott, you know, you dived in depth into this in your opinion piece. And, you know, what struck me with this is that, you know, striking down abortion does not make abortion stop. It makes them unsafe. And it goes, you know, and it doesn't allow women to have bodily autonomy. And even in these cases of sexual abuse and incest, that's not going to stop. So take us kind of through what you wrote about.
Yeah, you know, because you think about the implications and just the de facto effect of what's going to happen. You know, states are allowed to regulate abortion, would be able to regulate abortion. So some states will have legal abortion and some states won't. Idaho won't in most cases. States like Oregon and Washington and California will. And so obviously people will travel to other states to have an abortion. But if you think about that, that's really going to be accessible only to people who have the financial wherewithal or have the support system to do that. You think about a 16-year-old or 17-year-old girl having an unwanted pregnancy, might not have the wherewithal or the financial means or the support to travel out of state for an abortion. And so there's concern that, you know, abortions are going to go underground again. They'll become unsafe again. And, you know, those implications are serious for Idaho.
Well, and it goes back to this idea, Scott, that frankly, if you have the means and it is you or a daughter or a sister, you will have the means to have access to this. Once again, it is women of color. It is women with less access, with less financial means. This is what will happen. They will not have availability. There is this argument that you know, when we think of liberty, right? You're taking liberties away. It is a constitutional right. There is supposed to be a separation of church and state. And, you know, even the first sentence in Judge Alito's leaked opinion was that this is, you know, morally wrong. Well, by whose standards, right? There's so much to unpack, I think, with this. And the fact that we're talking about this in 2022 is, I shouldn't be astounded, but I am.
Right. And again, you know, I think what you've seen, too, is the further implications of the ruling. If the ruling does indeed get approved and whatever that final ruling looks like, the legal implications are pretty far ranging in terms of pregnancy. You know, if a state legislature has the power and the ability to declare life begins at conception, well, then there's going to be certain contraception methods and certain birth control methods that could be deemed illegal. You know, there's been talk about miscarriages, which is an interesting concept because, again, if a prosecutor or a court decides that a woman did things to cause her own miscarriage, that could be seen as illegal, as breaking the law. And so, you know, these kinds of implications, I think, are going to be discussed about in great depth as this ruling gets finalized. And we see mm-hmm. what the final wording of this ruling is. Those kinds of debates are going to be coming to the forefront.
Well, and there's such misinformation out there. I mean, I think that's the thing, Scott. When you think of a miscarriage or something like an ectopic pregnancy, we saw that in state legislatures across the country this year, there were lawmakers who don't even understand what an ectopic pregnancy is and that it is not viable with life of the fetus or the mother. In fact, the mother will die if that pregnancy is not terminated. It is as simple as that. And the embryo cannot survive. And yet we have uneducated people making these decisions.
Well, and it's worth noting that the 14th Amendment, upon which Roe v. Wade is based, and a number of other decisions, by the way, are based on the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment came about during the Civil War era, when states were passing laws that discriminated against African Americans and tried to usurp voting rights, and so the amendment seeks to enshrine that there are certain fundamental rights that states can't take away, that you can't have a slavery law in one state and an anti-slavery law in another state that slavery is a violation of human rights. And so that's why the 14th Amendment was passed. So you're absolutely right that if this is left to the whims and perhaps political misguided direction of some state legislatures, it has a whole host of implications for a whole number of laws.
Yeah. We could talk about this all day. There is more to get to. So, Don, I want to bring you into the conversation because a lot going on once again in regards to Cougar Island, which is in McCall. Tell us about this because it could potentially up for sale. And this is in the middle of Payette Lake.
Yeah. So if you've ever wanted to own an island, this might be your chance. But that has some folks upset. Cougar Island is a 14-acre island in Payette Lake. It is, I would say, about two-thirds of the way north from McCall through the lake. Right now, it has a single house on it. The house does not have external power. There is no, no pipes for water. There's no sewer system there. Obviously, there's ways to get around all those things, solar energy and septic systems and the like. But the owner of the house is on land. It leases from the Idaho Land Endowment. We've talked a lot about the Idaho Land Endowment in the last couple of years because of a proposal that failed to privatize a large chunk of the land around McCall. The Land Endowment, those lands are owned by the state of Idaho. They were granted to the state at its founding in 1890, but they're not public lands. They are lands that are to be used to maximize value to go to help fund education. And over the last decade and a half or so, there's been a somewhat contentious and also somewhat complicated process that allows people around Payette Lake in McCall or near McCall and Priest Lake in North Idaho who have these what are called cottage site leases to enter a process where they could put the land up for auction. And if they win, they would then own both the house on the land and the land itself. This helps drive returns to the Land Endowment. And this was a little controversial at first, but it's gone along fairly well. But the owner of the cottage site, the single cottage site on Cougar Island, wanted to enter this process and told the state that it wanted to do this, which triggered the Idaho Department of Lands, which administers the endowment, to look at if they should not just auction the one cottage site on Cougar Island, but all basically five plots of land, or the entire island, which is, again, 14 acres. People are upset. Really, anything that has to do with endowment lands in McCall tends to rile folks up. And the Valley County Commission actually earlier this week voted to write a letter to the Idaho Department of Lands saying that they are not in favor of this action going forth. This was previously approved or previously thought of. I'm not using the right word there, but they looked to move forward with this similar action in 2019. Similar controversy ensued, and the state decided to pull that back in early 2020. But the problem is the Idaho Land Board, which is made up of the governor, the state attorney general, the state superintendent, and other elected officials, set forth this process in 2010 that said, hey, if you have a cottage site, you can enter this what's called voluntary auction for ownership process. And the owner of the house on the cottage site on the island says, yeah, I want to do that. And so I think they're going to have an interesting needle to thread here. And just how it goes forth, I don't know. The Department of Land says that they still have some due diligence to do. They have to value each of the lots. And they have not set an auction date, although Corbett Bottles Auctions of Eagle has started to advertise for this. And I will say in full credit, the Star News of McCall actually first reported on this story, and then we did some additional reporting. So that's kind of how it first caught notice. And we're going to see what happens and if it goes through and what might happen to that island.
Yeah, I definitely not the last we're going to hear about this. Scott, we are about a week and a half away from the primary elections here in Idaho. And, you know, historically, newspapers give endorsements of candidates. But a lot of times, newspapers don't necessarily, and I should say news outlets as a whole, don't always sit down with these candidates. So kind of take us through where the Statesman is with this, because your board, your advisory board, has endorsed candidates in the past.
Yeah, and we have kind of a rule, a policy, I should say, that we won't endorse any candidate who does not agree to sit down with an interview with us. So we feel that our board has questions, that specific questions that we want to ask, and we feel that candidates should answer those questions from our board. And so we invite the candidates. We choose certain races. We wish we could do more, but we select a handful, maybe a dozen or 15 races or so to weigh in on. And we invite the candidates in those races to interview with us. I'm happy to report that all three candidates that we invited for the gubernatorial race, Governor Little, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, and Ed Humphreys all accepted our invitation to interview with us. And we interviewed all three candidates. We spent about an hour with each one of them and came up with our endorsements in that race. Unfortunately, with Lieutenant Governor's race, we only had one candidate agree to interview. Scott Bedke agreed to interview with us, and Priscilla Giddings declined our invitation. Well, I guess I should say she didn't even respond to our invitations. In the Secretary of State's race, we interviewed Phil McGrain, and unfortunately, Mary Souza and Dorothy Moon did not respond at all to our invitations. In the Attorney General's race, Lawrence Wasdin interviewed with the editorial board. Raul Labrador called me personally and said that he was declining the invitation. He didn't think he would get a fair shake with the editorial board, which is unfortunate. Art McCumber did not respond at all to our invitations. And then in the in the superintendent's race, we did interview Debbie Critchfield, and we interviewed Sherry Ibarra. Brandon Durst, the third candidate in that race, he was not able to make the original date, and we tried to schedule another date for him, and he just kind of ghosted us, so never responded back to further invitations. We have interviewed some candidates in legislative races. The race between Representative Ron Nate and Britt Raybould, we just interviewed both of them last week. Greg Cheney, we interviewed, and his opponent, his challenger, Chris Traikle, did not respond. And we've written about this over the course of the past couple of weeks, that we're seeing this trend that's growing where candidates are declining to respond to surveys, candidate surveys, just asking about their positions. They're declining debates. We had Governor Little decline to participate in the Idaho debates. We had Priscilla Giddings decline to participate, and Representative Mike Simpson declined a debate. You know, we feel that this is a real disservice to voters, that if we're going to be relegated to getting information from, you know, 30-second campaign attack ads that are just filled with, you know, slogans and mottos and just kind of tripe sound bites, you know, it's really doing a disservice to the voters. Like I said, we interviewed all three gubernatorial candidates for an hour each. We were really able to get in depth and ask follow-up questions and really discern the differences between the candidates so that we could make an endorsement. Endorsements kind of went away, and there are papers that are still kind of saying we're not going to do endorsements anymore. We believe in them, and we brought them back a couple years ago because we found that readers really did value them. They do really well with readers. They appreciate the depth and the analysis. It's more than just a tweet opinion. It's more than just, attacking the other side. It's really listening to what they have to say and analyzing where they stand on the issues and determining who the best candidate is.
Right. And we should note too that, you know, there are people who would say, well, you know, news outlets only endorse liberal candidates. That is not the case. with news outlets in the state of Idaho. The Idaho Statesman, Scott, I mean, your organization has in the past endorsed Democrats and endorsed Republicans.
Sure. And, you know, again, an editorial and an endorsement is not the end of the world. It's not the end all be all.
Right.
It's an opinion. It's an opinion of a group of people. We have several people who are in our newsroom who are on the board. We have community members on the board. Christy Perry, former Republican state representative, is on the board. J.J. Saldana with the Commission for Hispanic Affairs is on our board. And then we have newsroom editors. And it's just, it's our opinion, and you can disagree with that opinion. And that's what letters to the editor and guest opinions are for. And it's part of a healthy debate and healthy dialogue to disagree. We feel that endorsements from an editorial board of a newspaper still have great value to participate and to further that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Don, affordable housing is something that we have talked about numerous times on the program. You and your staff have covered this tirelessly. Can we talk about the city of Boise wanting more affordable housing? Instead, there's going to be what's, I guess, being called some modest housing coming to a certain area of town.
Yeah, so I used to live in this area. It's the area of Overland and Orchard, and people who've been in Boise a long time will remember the old Fred Meyer store. It was a Grand Central. It was a furniture outlet store for a while. And about 15 years ago, the store was torn down, as well as a couple of other stores in the Hillcrest Shopping Center. And it's been a big empty field ever since. And there's been several attempts to build apartments on this site. It's close to transit. It's there's an Albertsons store there, lots of services nearby. And they haven't worked out for one reason or another. And a couple of years ago, Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel, who might have been at the Idaho Press at the time, I don't recall, wrote a story about how the Boise City Council was going to spend about $2.5 million to buy the land. And what they wanted to do was add this to their housing land trust. And the city's model for this is to take some land holdings that they own, work with a private developer through an RFP process, and incentivize affordable housing. It's right now under construction on its first project right at the corner of Franklin and Orchard, so exactly a mile away. And the idea is the city would own the land, the developer could come in and build the buildings, and it would help lower the overall cost. So it wanted to do that on this site, but the idea fell through. There was some questions over the requirements with the site, and the owner of the adjacent Hillcrest Shopping Center had some cross-access issues, and so the deal didn't go through. Now, the owner of the old Fred Meyer site is moving forward with getting approvals for an apartment complex that would be along Philippi Street, and they didn't detail what the rates would be, but it's unlikely that they're going to be sort of strictly affordable in the way the city of Boise defines them. They did say that the apartment units would be quote unquote modest, like you alluded to. Neighbors are already upset. Neighbors are often upset, frankly, about any project that we write about these days. That's not uncommon. We'll see where this goes. The land is essentially zoned appropriately for what the developer wants to build here, but it definitely was a lost opportunity for maybe some more affordable housing in an area of the bench, frankly, that is in need of it. Every corner of our valley is in need of affordable housing.
No, exactly. And it is probably one of the greatest issues that we are continuing to deal with is the lack of affordable housing. So just appreciate that reporting, Don, on that. So, Audrey, I want to get back to Dr. Ryan Cole. We talked about this in the beginning of the program today because there is another part of this investigation that you found. And this is that he misdiagnosed two patients, and one of those individuals spoke with the Idaho Capital Sun. Can you talk to us about this?
Yeah, so as a pathologist, Dr. Cole can diagnose basically through a microscope. That's kind of what pathologists do. And so in this case, there were two patients, totally unrelated. One I found out about in a complaint to the Washington Medical Commission. And I tried to contact the physicians who were named as her primary care provider, and then a surgeon, wasn't able to talk with them. But what the complaint said was that she was diagnosed with a type of cancer, serous carcinoma, that can be pretty aggressive and has a not great cure rate. So she had surgery fairly quickly, had her reproductive organs removed, and some other tissue from her abdomen, and they sent it on to be evaluated, which is something that, you know, happens when you're trying to figure out how pervasive is this cancer? Right. What do we need to do to treat it? And it came back, she actually didn't have cancer. And the complaint said, you know, she understandably and her surgeon understandably were very angry. And the other patient came to us. So, and I talked with her and I looked at her medical records. I confirmed what she was telling me. And she had been diagnosed with basically a precursor to a gynecological cancer and a really rare one. So, she said that when she went in to see the cancer specialist, they sent it off to be reviewed, the same sample, and it also showed no precancerous changes. And she told me that when she talked with the cancer specialist, they said, we sent this off because we've been getting false results from this lab. So, or from this physician. So, you know, for her, it was really upsetting. She did not have a surgery. But you know, she was worried about her health. And in addition, she said this was also upsetting to her because she had a family member who is high risk for COVID-19 and didn't get vaccinated after watching one of Dr. Cole's videos. And so for her, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of personal in two different ways.
Audrey, how much does this play? Sorry to interrupt you, but how much, and I guess we don't know this, but I mean, I think we should point out that Dr. Cole in the past has also made statements saying that the COVID-19 vaccine causes more cancers. And then all of a sudden we have these misdiagnoses. And it begs the question as to why we would see this. I mean, mistakes happen. I mean, doctors are human. It's just that there seems to be another narrative going on as well.
No, and that's absolutely true. Doctors make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes because we're all human, like you said. And I don't know if this is, you know, indicative of a larger issue, but yes, the reason it's relevant is that he's been saying that he's seen a 20 times increase in cancers, and he's specified gynecologic cancers, endometrial cancers, that he's seeing an uptick in. And both of these women, it was gynecologic cancer screenings they were getting. So, so it's, you know, the question that the complaint to the Washington Medical Commission raised was exactly that. He's saying that there's a giant spike in cancers. He is attributing them to the COVID-19 vaccine. I have not seen any publicly released research that backs up that claim, I should say. He has not produced anything that I've seen, at least. So the question was, if he's making more misdiagnoses than typical, are they informing his belief that the vaccines are causing this, or that he's seeing an uptick, or vice versa? And so that was kind of how that came to be part of the complaint file that Washington Medical Commission has.
If you want to read Audrey's articles, go to the Idaho Capital Sun. They are definitely worth a read, and we will put links on our website as well for folks to read that. Dawn, let's talk a little bit about, I think it's fair to say, a major expansion that is set at the Villages at Meridian?
Yeah, we've been expecting this for quite some time. The Village of Meridian is one of the largest shopping centers in the region, at the corner of Eagle Road and Fairview, the busiest intersection in the state. They have been capped in the total number of square footage that they could develop because of an agreement with the state of Idaho and the Ada County Highway District on highway improvements around there. Those highway improvements along Eagle Road, including an additional lane, are currently in progress. Once complete, it would allow the developers to expand. And so if you've driven to the Village and you've headed northbound along Eagle and you've turned right into the, I call it the Noodle Bowl. I probably shouldn't say that on the radio. It's the area where they have the fountain and all the little roads that kind of
That makes sense. Bowl. Yeah.
So my wife knows what that means, and maybe everybody else hopefully does too.
We're now just going to call it that.
Yeah, no, I think they should brand it that way, and I'll take copyright credit.
Okay, perfect.
Anyway, so you're turning in there, you notice there's a bunch of dirt lots, and
yeah.
As the developer, the general manager for the development told me a few weeks ago, you know, we don't intend it to be like that forever. And so we did a story saying that they would apply later this year, and 4 days later they applied. And so we did two stories in a week about it. And it's really an interesting project. They're going to do a pair of six-story buildings that would be on either side of what's called Long Wing Lane. And they would consist mostly of apartments in the two buildings. The ground floor would have some restaurant and entertainment spaces. I went and looked at the co-developer's website, and it has a rendering, and it has a couple of restaurants in it. And I'm going to say the name of one of the restaurants. I always like to caution that sometimes renderings aren't indicative of what a final lease will be. But there's a San Diego restaurant called The Crack Shack that would be there. And it is referring to a restaurant focused on chicken dishes. So chickens come from eggs and eggs crack. Don't let your mind go anywhere else.
This comes from a former Top Chef winner, Richard Blaze.
It does.
So see,
it does.
I'm in the know here, Don. We'll see what happens.
You know about the Crack Shack, Gemma. So we'll see if that happens. There's also a Seattle area chain called Wild Thin. The big thing is this, I would call it fairly iconic six or seven story structure that would be a sky bridge that would go over the street that would connect the two apartment buildings. And it looks like a bridge, which is why this project is called the Bridge at the Village of Meridian. A formal application has not happened yet. This is what's called a pre-application phase. And so we found this in some public records, and I emailed the general manager out there and was like, "Hey, I saw you apply." And they're like, "Wait, what?" And so,
what do you know?
So this is still coming along. There's no formal announcement yet. But I do expect to see movement on this soon. And it's going to be a big expansion out there. People are going to go, "Wait, you're going to take away parking." Yes, but they're also going to add some additional structured parking there. And it will end up with quite a bit more parking spaces than it has presently. But we're talking about hundreds of apartments, and people could live right at the Village at Meridian if they so chose. And, you know, if I was still in my 20s and you told me I could live at the Village at Meridian, I'd probably be.
Yeah, I know, right? If you were back in your 20s, yeah. And it's fascinating, Dawn, because that has been, I mean, empty land, I mean, since the inception of the Villages. So no matter what, it is a matter of time until something is built on that. It will not stay vacant.
Yeah, and you know, there's obviously, that's not the only thing that's happening out there. Boise Dev first reported in February that In-N-Out is looking to build its first Idaho location at the Village. And there's still additional land out there. We're working on
I actually have to stop you right there because I'm out of time, Don. You can't. I am literally getting counted down from my producer. So thank you to Don Day, Audrey Dutton, and Scott McIntosh. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.